This podcast is being generously sponsored by Moshe Kraus, a mortgage broker licensed in New York and New Jersey with 10 years experience working with the company Funding Source, who has over 20 years experience in the business. Moshe is a creative broker who will make sure that your mortgage gets done. NMLS number 1284060. To contact him, 845-425-5363, extension 208. To sponsor or to support the podcast, please contact svarimchatter@gmail.com. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarim Chatter podcast. For this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Professor Yerachmiel Robert Brody, who is an expert on the Ga'anim, many books on the Ga'anim. His famous one is the Ga'anim of Babylonia and the Shaping of Medieval Jewish Culture, which has also been published in Hebrew as well. Numerous other books, biography of Sadhu Ga'anim, numerous other books that he can talk about. And we'll obviously be discussing the Ga'anim. And with that, thank you, Professor Brody, for joining me.
My pleasure.
So why don't we start off, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background.
I grew up in New York in a modern Orthodox family and setting. Studied at Yeshiva University High School, and I was very interested from a very young age, both in Gemara and in math. My original plan was that I was going to be a mathematician professionally and learn on the side. I got a bit of a way down that track and then decided that I didn't really want to spend the rest of my life working as a mathematician, and I wanted to make the learning the central thing that I did, and changed over and got into rabbinic literature as a profession. About the time when I was thinking seriously of making that change, Professor Shraga Abramson, Alav HaShalom, was in New York on a sabbatical, and I studied with him there and ultimately decided that I was going to go to Israel in order to continue studying with him and working under his supervision. And essentially, you could say that I inherited his place at Hebrew University, where I taught for many years.
So is that how, you know, you got into the Ga'anim? I mean, how and when exactly did you get into the whole period of the Ga'anim?
Well, I had been very curious about them for years before that. I remember, well, I guess when I was in high school mostly, reading Rishonim and having the impression that here were these people that they talked about with great reverence, but I didn't know anything about them directly, and nobody else around me seemed to know anything very much about them directly. So it's kind of heard of these echoes of the Ga'anim in the Rishonim, and it very much piqued my curiosity about who and what they were. And then when I had the opportunity, as I say, I was thinking of moving in one way or another into studying, say, rabbinic literature full time, and had the opportunity when my path crossed with Abramson's path that definitely came together with my earlier interests and led me to that specialization.
Right. So, I mean, I guess we can just, get right into it. Is everyone here is probably, well, the listeners have probably heard of the Ga'anim, they probably heard of the time period and the Savaroyim before that. I guess we should touch on them as well. But I guess whatever knowledge people have of the Amoraim, it probably in general mainly just skips. They just heard of the Ga'anim. They don't really know much about them. So I mean, where do we, you know, start? I'll let you just start off just discussing the Ga'inim, if you want to talk about the Sevaroyim first, and, you know, the overall time period, the years, and just the basic background to start.
Well, first of all, I guess I should say some of these things are controversial, and without getting into all of the different opinions and all the controversies, I could tell you briefly the way that I understand it, which is we hear about these fairly mysterious people called the Sevaroyim. If you put together all of our early sources that talk about Sevaroyim, you might get up to 2 pages. So we don't know very much about them at all. And there's a lot of room for speculation. I can tell you that my understanding, basically following Rav Shri Ragoam, is that the Sevaroyim were operating for a pretty short time in the 5th century CE. And they're given the credit for putting the finishing touches, so to speak, on the Gemara. And basically, the understanding you get if you read Rav Shrira is that there was a break in the functioning of the yeshivas in Bavel, middle to the later 6th century. And when the yeshivot came back into operation, people felt that they were no longer in the same period as the Sevaroyim. And that, I think, is where we start the Gaonic period. So I consider the Gaonic period to go from about the middle of the 6th century to about the middle of the 11th century, nice round number of 500 years. But the truth of the matter is that for the first part of the Gaonic period, we almost don't know anything either. Similarly to the Sevaroyim period, for the early Gaonic period, we have very, very little information. We really know something about the Gaonim for about, say, 300 years, from about somewhere in the 8th century to somewhere about the middle of the 11th century.
I think something that we should just touch on here is first of all, you mentioned the Sevaroyim a little bit. What does it mean, Sevaroyim? And then more so, we'll get into more of the Gaonim, is, you know, what does Gaonim mean? And what does Gaonim mean? Where does the word come from that they were called Gaonim?
Okay, well, you know, Sevaroyim, the name Sevaroyim is built in the same fashion as Tanaim and Amoraim. So if a Tana is someone who recites, and the Amora is someone who says, the Sevara is presumably someone who thinks or offers opinions. Now, where did this designation come from? We don't really know. I mean, what always happens with these terms throughout Jewish history, as far as I understand it, is that these are not names people give themselves, they're names that the people who come after them give them. So you know, Tanaim probably didn't say to each other, I'm a Tana, you're a Tana, but the Amoraim said those people were Tanaim, and later on, let's say the Sevaroyim said those people were Amoraim, and the Gaonim said, and those people were Sevaroyim. Actually, Gaon, in the usage of Rav Shrira Gaon, certainly when he writes in his Ziger Rav Shrira Gaon, as far as his usage goes, Gaon means head of a yeshiva. And basically, that's pretty much what we think it means. The theory is that it's an abbreviation of Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov, which is an expression that we do find sometimes in the sources. But no, I don't think anybody is 100% sure how they came to have that title. And it's not the only title that's used in the early period. Actually, if you read Shuvos Gaonim, when they talk about other Gaonim, they tend not to say so-and-so Gaon, they say Ma Rav so-and-so. And that's kind of the title that distinguishes a Gaon. It's a little bit complicated.
Yeah, I think nowadays it seems to mean something else. It's like, I know, just for example, look at all these like Israeli auction houses. They put like an auction. A Gaon is like the genius. I don't know where that came from exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't done a study of it where that usage first appears, but that's certainly what it means in modern Israeli Hebrew. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So I guess we can either start, you know, with the position of the Gaon, where it comes from, or we can go the other way, which is that you just mentioned that the Gaon was a position of an yeshiva. So, I mean, what were these two, the big yeshivas in Bavel that had Gaonim? I mean, where did those start? And what were their names? And what's this background story on them?
Okay, well, we know that the two main yeshivas were called Tzura and Pumbedita. They also had synonymous names, kind of. Tzura was also called Matha Machasya, and Pumbedita was also called Naharda. But they're talking about the same two institutions. It's a kind of a debated question to what extent you see these yeshivot as straight continuations of things that existed already in the time of the Gemara. There's a big scholarly debate about whether there were well-defined institutions called yeshivot, or that we can call yeshivot already in the time of the Gemara or not. We certainly see them as much more well-defined institutions by the time of the Gaonim. They physically, towards the end of the Gaonic period, both of these yeshivot relocate to Baghdad, which is the capital of the Islamic Empire. But they continue to be called the Yeshiva of Tzura, the Yeshiva of Pumbedita, the same way Hebron Yeshiva continues to be Hebron when it's in Yerushalayim. And these two yeshivot dominate the intellectual world of whatever part of the Jewish world is subject to the Babylonian rabbinic interpretation. So you have, during this period, you have a competing center in Eretz Yisrael, and there are some parts of the diaspora that see themselves as subject to Eretz Yisrael, and other parts that follow Bavel, and there are some places where there's a competition going on between the two of them. And then you have Jews who reject Rabbinic Judaism, but within Rabbinic Judaism, the Babylonian side of the world basically emanates from these two yeshivot.
Now, were there any like stark differences between the two, or it was just like we have today, just rival yeshivas?
Again, something of a controversial question, or certainly a complicated question. I think that the sources that we have don't show us very much in the way of differences between the two yeshivas at all. But it's complicated because, for example, a great many of the tshuvot that we have are anonymous. We don't know which yeshiva they came from. So there's been a tendency of people trying to build up a portrait of Tzura as being one thing and a portrait of Pumbedita as being another thing. I'm very skeptical about it. Both, as I say, because I think there are very few sources that talk about any kind of consistent difference, and because I think that depends on simplifying the situation within each one of the two yeshivas, because there were Definitely differences of opinion within each yeshiva, and you could see changes in time. What one Gaon in Sura would say was not necessarily going to be the same as the Gaon who had come before him or the Gaon who came after him. So the people who have pictured a kind of two monolithic institutions and then put them in opposition to each other. And I think the picture is much more nuanced than that.
Okay, so I know I went a little bit, hope I didn't jump around for everyone too much. I mean, we'll get back to the yeshivas because it's not like a yeshivas of today. We'll have to explain what they were. But I think we should go back now and talk about the Gaon. So each yeshiva had a Gaon. And I think at this point you should talk about, you know, the position of the Gaon, how it came to be, how one got it, and discuss the Gaon a little bit more.
Okay, well, the Gaon was the Rosh Yeshiva. And, you know, that's a synonymous title. To say Resh Metivta is another way of saying the Gaon. As I said, in the language of Rosh Rira, he can talk even about when he's talking about the time of the Amoraim or the Savaraim, he'll say so-and-so was the Gaon, meaning he was the Rosh Yeshiva. So how exactly the Rosh Yeshiva was chosen, we don't really know. It appears that he was chosen by the elder chachamim in the yeshiva. There were times when we hear about factions having competing candidates for the position of Gaon. We're obviously not in a position to know what was going on behind the scenes. There are people who suspect that there were alliances and deals, and this time around I'll support your guy, but you have to promise to support mine the next time. But we really don't know. We do know that the Rosh Gola or the Rosh Galuta, who was the kind of secular political representative of the Jews, had some kind of role in picking the Gaon, but we don't know whether this was a real substantial role or a ceremonial role involved in the ceremonies when the Gaon was appointed. And probably it wasn't consistent because the balance of power within the yeshivas and between the yeshiva and the Rosh Gola changed over the course of time. So, for example, Rosh Rira tells us that in an early period, he doesn't really know the whole chain of heads of the yeshiva and Sura, because the Rosh Gola used to interfere with them and appoint new ones and depose old ones. But then from a certain point onwards, he knows. So when you get to Rav Sadia Gaon, the famous story is that he was brought in and appointed by the Rosh Gola, and after a little while they had a fight, and the Rosh Gola tried to depose him, and Rav Sadia tried to depose the Rosh Gola, and things went on like that for several years before someone intervened and achieved some sort of reconciliation between them. So we did, most likely, as I say, the main thing that decided the Gaon was what the Chachamim in the yeshiva wanted, but from time to time, other people could get their, stir up the pot one way or another bit too.
So I guess what was a little unique about them, at least to people listening, we should be clear of this. It wasn't like a yeshiva today where it's always, usually the yeshiva's son or son-in-law. It was literally they picked someone that was the most, I mean, you could talk a little bit about that. Who was the one that they picked? Was it the second in command or someone else? And also there was only, I believe, one father then son who succeeded him, right?
Yes, it was. One thing you could say about it is that it was not inherited. The unique exception is the exception of Rav Shri Agon and his son Rav Haya right at the end of the Gaon period in Pupadita. Now, there were families that produced a lot of Gaonim, but with gaps in between. So there are, you can trace in several cases, someone who's the son of a Gaon and sometimes the grandson of a Gaon, but there might be decades in between the time when the father was at the head of the yeshiva and the time when the son was. Again, we don't really know. There was a position of the Dayana de Bava, who was the second in command of the yeshiva. We don't really know whether it was normal or expected that he would then move up to the position of Gaon when the previous Gaon died or retired. Something that we don't have the sources for. He might have been considered the kind of leading candidate, but I think the decision had to be made when the position opened up, and he wouldn't necessarily move into it. The thing is that we generally don't know the names of people who were in that position at any given time, so we can't track them and say, okay, 80% of the time the Av Beit Din became the next Gaon, or it only happened 10% of the time.
Now, this question might be a little bit complicated because, like you said, we don't have a lot of information about the beginning, but do we know or have any estimate of how many Gaonim there were over from the beginning of the period till the end? And then, okay, do we have some sort of number or estimate on that?
Oh, that we do. But our major source of this kind of chronological information is this Igeret Rav Shri Agon, which was an answer to a bunch of questions that were sent to him. We know when, 986, and the Igeret is famous for different reasons, because it talks about the development of the Mishnah and the Gemara, and then it's responding to a list of questions. And if you look at the questions, there's fairly detailed questions about how did the Mishnah come about, and why is it that the names of the Chachamim who are mentioned in the Mishnah are after the Churban Bayis Sheni? If in fact Tosh Bapez is so ancient, why aren't those names mentioned, and so on and so forth? And questions about the Gemara and about Tosefta and Midrash Halacha. And at the very end, they say, and could you tell us about the Gaonim who have been the heads of the yeshiva from that time until now? So the last, say, fifth of Igeret Rav Shri Agon is devoted to the post-Talmudic period and basically to lists of Gaonim of Sura and Pumbedita. As I mentioned earlier, he says that at the very beginning, he doesn't have good records. He doesn't have good information about Sura, but his information is okay already, starting around 700. And then he goes on, and that last part of the Igeret is basically jumping back and forth between the two yeshivot. He gives you lists of so-and-so was the Rosh Yeshiva, generally tells you for how many years, sometimes tells you beginning in what year and ending in what year. So we have pretty good information about that. And the answer is, you're talking about a few dozen heads of each yeshiva over a period of, let's say, 400 years, something like that.
Do you want to, maybe at this point, I'm thinking we should maybe list, to mention a couple of the famous ones. Obviously, keep mentioning Rav Shri Agon. Maybe at this point, before we get back to a little bit more what they did, and the yeshivas did a couple of famous Gaonim that we know of.
Well, in some ways, Rav Shri Agon is perhaps the most famous, because mostly because of this unique Igeret that he wrote, which provides us with both historical information that we wouldn't have otherwise, and his understanding of the way the Mishnah and the Gemara came about, which is our earliest perspective on big questions in understanding Chazal. So he was the Gaon of Pumpedita, the later part of the 10th century. His son, Rav Chaya Gaon, again, might have a claim to be the most famous of the Gaonim. He at least has the reputation of being, I think it was Ibn Ezra who described him as being the last Gaon in time and the greatest in stature. So I can't say whether he's the greatest in stature. He wasn't exactly the last Gaon, but he was very near the end of the period. And Rav Chaya is famous both because we have a huge quantity of tshuvot from him and because of books that he wrote. So the writing of books is something that was only characteristic of the later part of the Gaonic period. The writing of tshuvot is characteristic all along the way, but Rav Chaya excelled in both of those departments. And the other very famous Gaon, I would say, is Rav Sadia Gaon. Sadia is famous for many things, including being the first Gaon to do a great many things that were outside of the traditional role of the Gaon. So writing biblical commentaries, writing philosophical works, grammatical works, piyutim. So he very much expanded the definition of what a Gaon could do, or perhaps even might be expected to do some of those things. So he's also famous among people who would have encountered him not necessarily through his tshuvot or his halachic writings, but because he dealt in so many other fields as well. Then you have other relatively famous Gaonim, like Rav Natronai Gaon, that I started my career working on, because we have a large number of tshuvot from him. You have Rav Yehudai Gaon, is famous, but a lot of the things that are attributed to Rav Yehudai Gaon aren't really Rav Yehudai Gaon. You have Rav Amram Gaon, who's famous because of the Sidur. Now, those are probably the most famous of the names among them.
Okay, so perhaps we'll get back to some of those a little later. So back to the Gaon and the yeshivas that we were talking about is, so, you know, what were their jobs in the yeshiva? I think, and then we'll get into the structure of how the yeshiva functioned. So I think you already mentioned that they wrote a lot of tshuvas. So first of all, were there those questions that they got locally, and they wrote questions to other countries or to where? And just in the yeshiva, what did it mean to be a Rosh Yeshiva? Were they just some sort of, you know, what did that entail exactly?
I would say that the best of our knowledge, the job definition of being the Gaon included three main functions. So one was being the head of the yeshiva, and we have a limited amount of information about what that entailed. We basically have one description of what went on during the Yachekala, when the Gaon would conduct these large sessions for many, many students and learn through a masechet that the students had been working on at home, and then they would come for the month of the Kala and learn the masechet together, and the Gaon would test people and ask them questions, and depending how well they had been studying and how well they did on their bechinas, they got allocated different amounts of financial support. So that's one function, which is, I suppose, the one which is the classic Rosh Yeshiva model. The other thing is indeed the yeshiva was the place that people came with their questions. Questions in halakha, questions in learning, were sent to these yeshivot. Now, probably people also came with questions in person. Almost certainly they did. But the material that we have consists of answers to questions that were sent in writing from relatively distant places. Most of the, again, we don't know where most of the questions originate, but the ones that we know about are mostly from North Africa and Spain. There are small numbers from lots of other places, but those are the main communities that are in regular contact with the Gaonim in Bavel. And the function, officially, the Shuvot are not written by the Gaon as an individual. They're written by the yeshiva, and the Gaon as the head of the yeshiva. And we know that they're discussed, and they have to be issued during a time that the yeshiva is in session. If a question came during vacation, they waited until everybody came back from vacation to answer them. Right? There's one case in which the Gaon apologizes that it's taken so long, but when your questions came, everybody had gone home for Pesach, and we had to wait until they came back before answering them. So at the very least, as a formal thing, the Tshuvot represent the voice of the yeshiva, not just the voice of an individual. But already in the time of the Gaonim, they talk about the Tshuvot as if they are the Tshuvot of one person, of the Gaon, who's the head of the yeshiva. We don't know how much input the other members of the yeshiva really had. We don't know whether it was just a formality, but really it was simply the Gaon who dictated the answers, or whether there was a real give and take and perhaps voting on what they thought was the right answer. So that's another one of the things that our sources just don't let us answer. But the third thing that we know is that in this period, the two yeshivot and the Rosh Golah divided up a large part of the Jewish world into three territories that were called Rishuyot, and one Rishut belonged to Pumbedita, and one belonged to Surah, and one belonged to the Rosh Golah. And within the territory that belonged to a particular yeshiva, the Gaon would also appoint Dayanim that he would send out to the different communities in this territory, so that the yeshiva indirectly, or not so indirectly, was exercising a great deal of influence over the court system and the halakha throughout the territory that was assigned to it, and was also collecting taxes from the Jews throughout this territory. So that, I think, an important part of the Gaon's job was being the administrator of this rather far-flung Rishut. And then, as I say, there were things that were not part of the classical model of the Gaon, but at least towards the end of the period, they became additional options, like writing books, started by Sadja and followed by some of the Gaonim who came after him.
So that was a new thing. So we know that the earlier Gaonim, it's not that we're just missing their writings. They didn't really write, you're saying, Svarim like that.
They wrote Tshuvot, but they, you can say pretty much definitely that was the only genre in which they wrote.
Right, okay. So I think it's important also to explain a little bit what the yeshiva looked like and what happened there. I think today everyone has a certain picture in their mind when they hear yeshiva, a contemporary yeshiva. That's not, I think, what it looked like. So what did it mean to have a yeshiva? What was the functioning, the day-to-day, and what went on there?
Well, you're asking questions that are really hard to answer. What we know most about, and I wouldn't say that we know such a tremendous amount about that, but the most detailed description that we have is this one eyewitness description of what it looked like during the Yachei Kala. And he describes hundreds of students sitting in rows in front of the Rosh Hashiva and others standing at the back, and the kind of session that the Rosh Hashiva conducts, and how certain points towards the end of the month he tests the students and so on. We hardly know anything about what was going on in the yeshiva 10 months a year. So the Yarchei Kala are 2 out of the 12 months. We do, I think, know that the yeshiva was functioning year round, but with a much smaller number of students in attendance. And we don't really know very much at all about what the shiurim looked like. How many shiurim were there? There's one place that talks about what I think should be understood as saying that this yeshiva is proud of itself because it has three different levels of shiurim. But it's a little ambiguous. It's not even 100% clear that's what that source is saying. There's a place where Rav Shrira, when he's the Gaon and Rav Hai is still a young man, he talks about how Rav Hai is instructing the beginning students and teaching them about how the Gemara works. And so we don't know, among other things, whether there were lower schools and what kind of background people came with when they got to the yeshiva for the highest kind of learning that was available. What we do know, I think, and this is a general statement that is true of the Jewish world until relatively recently, and the number of people who were learning Gemara was quite small. The basic Jewish education was reading and Tanakh, and the group of people who became Lamdanim, Talmidei Chachamim, was a quite small part of the population. And to the best of our knowledge, the places that you went to do that were the Yeshiva of Surin Pupadita. Were there any other places, maybe on a smaller scale? We don't really know.
And I assume the yeshivas, like you're saying, they were dedicated to Gemara, which is also halacha. They weren't doing Tanakh, or were they learning other things? Do we know what they were learning?
We hear very little about it. It seems that there's some of that also. It certainly seems like the main occupations were Gemara and halacha, and they apparently had a kind of corpus of halacha outside of the Gemara, as well as studying the Gemara itself. But you hear, for example, there's one relatively famous story that's told by a rabbi from outside, talks about how he was at the yeshiva with Rav Hai, and they were learning, and they were stuck on the meaning of a pasuk in Tehillim, and Rav Hai sent somebody to ask the Catholicos, the Christian head of the Christian Academy, how they understand the pshat of this pasuk. And this fellow who's reporting on it was shocked and horrified that the Rosh Hashiva would be consulting with his Christian counterpart, so to speak, when it comes to learning Tanakh. But aside from the fact that it shows you something about the attitude of the Gaonim, it also shows you that there was something going on learning Tanakh. And it wasn't Parsha Shavua only, because they were dealing with Psukim in Tehillim. But we don't know anything really about, their Seder Yom, how much of the time that somebody was in a yeshiva they would have spent learning what. The impression you get is that it was overwhelmingly Gemara and Halacha.
Right, and one more thing I think we mentioned, I don't know if you want to go in depth on this, or people can definitely see this in your book, is that the actual structure, like you said, the way it would work, they had rows, they had like a Sanhedrin with a Reish Kala. Like, I don't know if you want to go, it's too technical. I mean, I know you talk about a lot in the book about the way that works.
Right. Well, that, as you say, that's probably not the most interesting aspect. But yes, we do. Again, part of this description of this fellow that we don't know anything about, who's called Rav Natana Bavli, and visited the yeshiva in the 10th century, right, gave us his description of the Achekala. He talks about the rows, and they're seated in seven rows, and the head of each row is called a Rosh Kala, and how they sit facing the Gaon. There's a whole story there in contrast to the position of Gaon when it comes to the seating within these 70 people who the Gaonim say are Kenegeda Sanhedrin. Those positions, there is a large degree of inheritance. So he tells us that if somebody dies and had a son who's worthy of taking over the father's place, that's what happens. If he didn't leave any son who was suitable, but he deserves a lower rank within this group of 70, then the Gaon assigns him to the appropriate place, and so on and so forth.
Right, and like I said, that's more technical, and that's all in the book. You discuss that. So, just one last thing to finish up on this is that on this part is that you do mention also you mentioned the Archekala, which is that we know those 2 months of the year and the rest of the year. Now, so we don't really know, you're saying, what happened the rest of the 10 months, and the Archekala was the part that we do know what they were learning essentially.
Well, what we know is that at the end of such a month, the Gaon would announce the Masechet for the next 6 months. And most of the students, the ones who didn't stick around year round, went home for 5 months and worked on that Masechet by themselves, or maybe in groups, or with whoever they could find in their hometown who might know it. And they came back where after 5 months, it was expected that they had learned the Masechta by themselves, and then the month of intensive study together was what went on in the yeshiva. But we know that there were people learning in the yeshiva all year, and we have a number of tshuvot that say this tshuva was written in, let's say, such and such a month, when we were studying this parak in the yeshiva. So we know a little bit that there was a given text being studied at any particular time. In fact, there were two texts being studied at a time. They would say something, you know, presumably what we call Iyun and Bekiyus or something like that. They say we're doing this parak, and we're also exposing this other parak, right? But we don't really have, let's say, anything like a description, anybody's diary of, you know, here's what my life in the yeshiva was like when I was a yeshiva bachur. We can kind of use our imaginations to try to fill things in, but that's about it.
Right. Now, the next part I want to ask you about is loaded parts. We're just touching it very little. Is that this is all in Bavel? I mean, Eretz Yisrael. What was going on in Eretz Yisrael at this time? Was the Goyim in Eretz Yisrael? Was Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael? What was happening in Eretz Yisrael?
Well, the answer is we know a lot less about Eretz Yisrael than we do about Bavel. With all the gaps in our knowledge about the Babylonian yeshivas, we're in relatively good shape when it comes to talking about Bavel, much better than we are when it comes to talking about Eretz Yisrael. What we can say is, throughout most of this period, if not all of it, there was one yeshiva, one main yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. And the head of that yeshiva was also called a Gaon. And it had titles and functions that were similar to those of the yeshiva in Bavel. The impression, well, more than the impression, what we can say, I think, is the Gaon, the head of the yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, had many of the functions of the Rosh Gola in Bavel. In other words, he was a political kind of head or representative for the Jewish communities of whatever part of the Jewish world was under the sway of Eretz Yisrael. And he comes across often as more of a communal political leader and less of a Rosh Hashiva. In other words, we have very, very few tshuvot from Eretz Yisrael, and very little halachic writing compared with what comes from Bavel. But we do have hundreds of letters where the Gaon of Eretz Yisrael is involved in the communal politics of Jewish communities. And the other thing that I can say is, in contrast to Bavel, where they seem to have concentrated very much on Gemara and Halakha, the curriculum in Eretz Yisrael seems to be much more varied. There seems to be much more involvement in Tanakh and Midrash and maybe other things as well, and less of an exclusive concentration on any one area.
So something I think we should mention, because we can't really have a podcast about Gaonim without discussing Rav Saji at all and his mainly his fighting against the Karaites, which is, you alluded to, non-rabbinic Judaism earlier. We're not going to go super in depth on Rav Saji. I think, Mr. Shem, if we could do a podcast on Rav Saji, I think it's a separate topic, really. But just, I think, to discuss, mention him a little bit, and especially, like I said, his fight against the Karaites and his writings that he did there.
Yeah, well, as you say, you could go on about Rav Saji for a long time, and he did many noteworthy things. But certainly one of them was that he was one of maybe the strongest defender of rabbinic Judaism against all kinds of competitors. The Karaites are the most famous, but there were others as well. And he started as a very young man, writing polemical works against people who had attacked some aspect or other of rabbinic Judaism. And he went on doing it throughout his career. Quite a few of his writings are anti the book against this one and the book against that one. We have significant pieces of some of these. I don't think we have any of them as complete works. And one of the interesting things about Rav Saji is that he manages to get polemics into other things that he writes. And he, in general, he doesn't like sharp boundaries between different genres. So when he's writing about halakha, he can get polemics in. He can get, when he's writing biblical commentary, he can get halakha in, and so on and so forth. So we see Rav Saji, certainly a recurring central theme in pretty much everything he does, is finding ways to fight Karaites and uphold Torah Shabbat Peh. You know, you want a nice example is one of his small works is a book about the unique words in Tanakh. So seemingly this is a work of lexicography, the kind of thing that a parshan might be drawn to, because when you're going through Tanakh, you hit these rare words and you have to work at trying to figure out what they mean. But actually, the other thrust of this little book is that the claim that the way that you understand these words is by reading rabbinic Hebrew, because a word that appears once in Tanakh could be a common word in rabbinic Hebrew, and that's how you know what the word means when you encounter it in Tanakh. And therefore, the Karaites who try to draw a distinction between Torah Shebichtav, which is good and legitimate, and Torah Shebichtav, which is something that these rabbis made up, you know, have no way of knowing what these words in Torah Shebiktav mean because they rejected Torah Shebaal Peh.
So which Gaon do we have the most writings from? I mean, I guess it's assumed it's Rav Sadia Gaon, but besides for him, I mean, are there other ones that we have a lot of writing from? You mentioned Rav Chaim Gaon with a lot of tshuvas, but are there any other ones that we have a lot of writings from?
The three Gaonim that wrote the most, aside from Tshuvot, were Rav Sadia. Again, we have tremendous amounts of what Rav Sadia wrote, and tremendous amounts have been lost. I mean, the thing that we haven't mentioned is that many of these books, well, basically all of the books that the Gaonim wrote, they wrote in Arabic, which was the spoken language, you know, outside of the yeshiva, and the language that was easiest for the Jews in the Islamic world. So Tshuvot got written in the language in which the question was written. If somebody wrote a question in Hebrew or in Aramaic, the answer would be Hebrew, Aramaic. But when the question came in Arabic, the answer was in Arabic. But when it came to writing books, they always wrote in Arabic. And what happened at a slightly later point, when the communities in the Islamic world declined and where the more important communities were in Europe, where people didn't know Arabic, these works got lost if they weren't translated into Hebrew. So a lot of what the later Gaonim wrote was lost. A lot of it is still lost. Some of it has been recovered because we've been able to put together some of these works from the Geniza. But when you talk about someone like Rav Sadia, you could fill bookshelves now with the material from Rav Sadia that we have, but we know that we're missing huge parts of it. So the same thing goes with Rav Shmuel ben Chafni, who was the Gaon of Sura several decades after Rav Sadia, and apparently wrote even more than Rav Sadia did, but less of it have survived. And then you have Rav Chaim Gaon. So Rav Chaim, as I said, has two great distinctions. He has a tremendous number of tshuvot that survived, and two of his halachic works were translated into Hebrew, so they survived and they were used by the Rishonim. So you have the Sefer HaMekach VaMemkar and the Mishpatei Shvuot. But those, I would say, are the Gaonim who occupy the most prominent places on our shelves.
Right, and Geniza, you obviously mean the Cairo Geniza, just to point out to people. And so this is a bit of a tricky question, but I'll ask it anyways. What would you say is the most influential writing that we have of the Gaonim? I know there could be different genres, so it's not like a simple question, but just what would you say to that?
That's a really hard question to answer. The most influential, no, if you're looking for influential in a historical sense, it's a Gered Rav Shriva Gaon. If you're looking for the most influential in a halachic sense, it's probably Sefer HaMekach VaMemkar of Rav Chaim. If you're looking for the most influential in terms of Hashkafa, probably be Sadia's Emunot V'Deyot. Well, it depends, I guess, which direction you want to go in.
Right. I think also something that we didn't mention, I think that we probably should, is the Sheiltas, right?
So yes, if you want, we are, now, the Shield is one of a number of works that are usually considered part of Gaonic literature. I haven't mentioned them because you've been asking me about the Gaonim, and probably these works were not written by Gaonim, but they were from the period, and they contain a lot of the same background as the Gaonim. So you have the Shilta, which is a kind of collection of drashot on mostly on Parshat HaShavua, also on some special occasions. You have what might be the most influential work of the period is Halachot Gedolot, which is certainly the work that was best known in Ashkenaz, and the one that, aside from Shuvot, you know, that's the main source of knowledge and influence of Gaonic literature in the Rishonim in Ashkenaz. You know, as I say, it was not written by one of the Gaonim. The Gaonim were rather critical of Halachot Gedolot, but for people who were far away from Bavel, this represented Torah HaGaonim to a large extent.
Yeah. Right. So, like you said, there's plenty more to discuss on that, so we'll leave it. So, what would you just, you know, as you wind down, what would you say is the, you know, you alluded to this much earlier about the end of the Gaonic period. I know for some reason it's always been stuck in my head that people always hear of High Gaon, but yeah, there really were Gaonim after.
Right. Well, we don't really know about the very end. You know, we know that it kind of tailed off rapidly after Avraham Gaon died. We know when he died. We have an exact date, and we know that for a few years afterwards, there were still heads of the yeshivot of Sur and Pumbedita, but it apparently didn't last much beyond his death. But it happened, I think, is that by this point there were already important and learned communities developing far away from Bavel, and the ties and their dependence on Bavel were getting progressively weaker. And Rav Hai, being the outstanding individual that he was able to kind of hold things together maybe for a couple of decades longer than they might otherwise have lasted. But after he died, it seems like things fell apart relatively rapidly.
So what would you say, to basically finish up the discussion, is what would you say is the Gaonim's lasting influence on Jewish life, especially today as we sit here? What was their lasting influence?
Well, I would say, very broadly speaking, it's because of the Gaonim that people later on knew how to understand Gemara. And certainly, I would say it was the Gaonim who were first responsible for turning the Gemara into the source of authority for rabbinic Jews. Now, I think that's the great historical shift of the Gaonic period. I mean, when the Gemara was developing or being put together, now it had all these different opinions in it. Sometimes at the end of a discussion, we're told what the halacha is. Most of the time, we're not. It's not self-evident that this was going to become the source and be applied as something from which you could derive the halacha on whatever question came up. And it was the Gaonim who first did that work. And again, you know, As I said, I first came to be fascinated by the Gaonim by learning Rishonim and hearing the way they talked about the Gaonim. And we don't normally appreciate it, but if you had taken away the Gaonic period, then anyone later on who came to the Gemara and wanted to understand it and wanted to apply it as a source of halakha would have been starting in a much, much different and more difficult place. And probably the whole period of the Rishonim and everything that came afterwards, although we're not usually aware of it, looks the way it does because of the Gaonim who came in between.
Right. Right. So hopefully this is a helpful primer starting point for people. It's obviously just barely scratching the surface of even what we know. There's so much more. So one other thing is that I would ask is, you know, what suggested reading? People want to go read up more on it. You know, this is your book, but what would you suggest is good suggested reading? People want to read up more on this subject.
Well, you do put me in a kind of uncomfortable place of plugging my own writing, but I would say that probably the place to start for somebody who's interested in learning more about it would most likely be the book that you mentioned earlier that I wrote about the Gaonim of Babylonia, or for somebody who's interested specifically in going more deeply into Rav Sadia Gaon, the book about Sadia Gaon, there's not a lot of introductions or broad treatments of the period. You can read, you know, you can find some of the books written by the Gaonim and read them. It kind of depends what your area of interest is. You know, if you're interested in halacha, the work that I would say is tremendously important is Otzar Gaonim, which is takes Gaonic material and arranges it according to the order of the Gemara, so that when you're learning a sugya and you want to know what, if anything, did the Gaonim have to say about it, you can find it there. The author, Binyamin Menashe Levin, Alav HaShalom, worked on this for years and died when he was near the beginning of Bava Metzia, and I and some colleagues have been working on completing that. So that's, you know, a way of making Gaonic learning accessible. Books like, again, if you're interested in Tanakh, you can read things. We have published parts of Rav Sadia's commentary on different books of Tanakh, Rav Shmuel ben Chofni's commentary on the second half of Breshit. If you're interested in Hashkafa, you can read the Emunot V'Dayot of Rav Sadia Gaon, which is also translated into English.
Yeah. I'm just going to jump and mention a few things. First of all, the Rav Shmuel ben Chofni Gaon was published by Mossad Rav Kook. It's out of print for many years. I don't know why. But they could maybe find it. Rav Sadia Gaon, yeah, Munus V'Deis is in English, but oddly enough, there isn't any amazing edition. I think there's being a new one prepared, right, worked on, but there's nothing that amazing right now. I know there's been other stuff published from him from the Gniza recently, a lot of full Svarim on Nach, and also on his Sefer HaMitzvahs has been published fairly recently, so there's plenty there. The other thing, Eitzer Gaonim, you mentioned, so you completed Bava Metzia and you also put up Ov Basra. Are there any more forthcoming volumes that you're working on as well?
Yes. The volume finishing Seder Nezikin God willing, will be out in the next few months. And meanwhile, my staff is working on a final volume on Kachim and Tara. And then we have to see if we're going to go back and do new versions of everything that Levin did.
Right, and I think Levine's notes are good. I mean, I think it's still available. It was fairly recently the set. I think people can still get it. Two things I think I would just mention is that, first of all, what would you say about Simcha Asaf's book? Right, you can still get some of his works on Ga'inim, I think.
His general book is very outdated. He published several collections of Tshuvot, which are important collections. I mean, they're not the only ones, but you know, they're important collections. That material, if to the extent that it was available to Levin when he was working on those Masechtot, is also, you can find it in Otzar Ganim. But his book, basically, I wrote my book about the Ganim of Bavel to replace Asaf, because Asaf's book was published already in the 50s, and it was written actually like decades before that, because these were notes that someone took on classes that he gave. So it's probably essentially close to 100 years old. So you know, sometimes certain parts of it are nice to read, but it gives you a very outdated picture of what we know about the Ganim and what we don't know.
Right. I think one last thing would be that the Art Scroll published fairly recently the introduction to the Talmud volume, where I think they included the translated edition of Igaros of Shirugain in there into English, if anyone wants it. I don't know if it was done before in English. And otherwise, is there another edition of that you'd recommend if someone wants to really read the history from the source? That would be what to read, right?
I haven't looked at the one that Art Scroll published, so I won't say anything about it. Yes, if you want to get us read up on the history, the primary source is the Gerdra Shriogon, but as I say, it basically gives you a chronological framework with not much more than that when it comes to the Gonic period. It gives you, basically, you get names and dates of who were the heads of the yeshiva and a very few bits, nuggets of additional information thrown in. So it provides you with a framework into which you can put all of these other sources and try to get as comprehensive a picture as possible. Reading it by itself, it doesn't give you a great deal.
Okay, so I will include links, Mr. Shem, in the discussion, the show's notes to your book, like I mentioned, the Gaonim of Babylonia and the Shaping of Medieval Jewish Culture, which is from Yale University Press, and also the biography of Reb Sajagain, which is also in English, available from the Lippmann Library. I will add that there as well. There are Hebrew editions of both those books if anybody wants them. They're not, I don't know how easy they are to order to America. So people can, I think the Reb Sajagain is from Zalman Shazar, right? And the book in the Gaonim is from Yad HaRav Nisim, right? That's correct?
Yes. Actually, when it comes to the Sajja book, the English edition is better because it has notes, and the Hebrew appeared in a series where they didn't want notes. When it comes to the general book on the Ganim, the Hebrew one is better for those who read Hebrew comfortably enough. It's more up to date and has things that I left out of the English edition because I thought they wouldn't be of interest to English readers, but that I put back in the Hebrew.
Right. Are there any other projects besides, if I just ask you this, besides the Itzig item that you're working on right now that you want to mention or no?
Well, as far as the Ganim are concerned, that's the major project that's on now. I'm also working on Masachet Ketubot and have a commentary that I hope will be out soon. Takes us into another field.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you very much, Professor Brody, for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Good night.